If you're young, there is a bias against you. If you are an immigrant, there is a slight bias against you. And if you're technical, there is a bias against you. And I thought I had all three. So,
so you get a trifecta. From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashok Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. So I'm here today with Jyoti Bansal, who's the founder and CEO of AppDynamics that was recently sold to Cisco for $3.7 billion. Jyoti is an IIT Delhi graduate. Go IIT Delhi. And he moved to the US right after graduating and was an engineer at three different startups, the last of which was Wiley, one of the early monitoring companies. And after his stint at Wiley, he started AppDynamics. Thank you for joining us today, Jyoti.
Great to be here.
And you went through the whole journey from, you know, an idea to 50, 60 million in revenues and a company that was worth several billion dollars in the period that you were a CEO. Tell us a little bit what that journey was like for you personally as a technical founder to CEO.
You know, I was working on this early monitoring company. I knew the gap in the market, but at least I believed strongly, like, you know, that the world of software is changing. You know, people are building more of these distributed cloud-based applications. And there is a big gap in how to monitor when something goes wrong in these kind of applications. And someone has to solve it. I had like an idea of what is the right technology approach that's very different that would solve this problem, right? So, but I had to code it, you know, and prototype it and start working on it. And at the same time, I had to start raising capital because I knew I need to raise capital to do things.
It was And so fundraising was easy and, you know, you got three term sheets in the first week?
You know, I got rejected by 20 VCs. You know, I pitched to a lot of VCs. And, you know, people would be like, you know, I was my first time founder. I had no experience managing teams, managing people. I was in my 20s at that time, a sole founder as well.
And yeah, solo founder is hard. Is even harder.
Yes, and so people will reject for all sorts of reasons. You know, some people is like the market is not large enough. Some people will say this is already a solved problem. Some people will say we don't invest in a sole founder. Some people will say it's too early. You're not ready. All sort of different reasons, right? And so it does happen, but it's a learning process. It took me some time to learn like what does it take. The main thing I realized, like, you know, it has to be a complete story. That you it's like unless you can tell and sell a complete story, you're not going to get people excited. And what are the elements of the story, right? And to me, I realized like if you are pitching to venture firms, really, there are three elements of the story that has to come together. One is, why could this be a $1 billion company? Because for the whole venture model depends on that, as you know, right? Yeah. Which is like, you know, that you make a lot of bets and you look at like some of the bets will go very big. So it's like really, go big or go home is
yes,
the venture
that's
model,
the model,
right?
So first question is why will this be a $1 billion?
Why could like because it's like every VC knows like you know most companies won't become that. So, but at least they want to know like if everything goes right, which the probability of
absolutely.
Everything going right
no,
is not very high.
Right.
That if everything goes right, can this be a $1 billion company, right? So I learned to how to tell that story like why this is a big market, and you know why this could be like you know be a $1 billion company. Why this is not a because you know to kind of address that part of the story like how software is changing our lives. You know how much software is being built. How the complexity of software is changing, you know, why, you know, this market and the spend will continue to grow kind of stuff, right? Then the second part of the story I also learned is like people want validation. You know, initially I was struggling because I couldn't show much validation. So I started like, you know, finding prospective customers to talk to on LinkedIn and other kind of sources like that. And I would, you know, record their interviews with their permissions and use them as a validation mechanism. So then in my pitch, I would talk about, okay, I talked to these 20 potential customers and which who have validated what I'm looking at. And these are the quotes and you can, you know, go and, you know, listen to these interviews. And that kind of address the validation kind of thing. Like, you know, it's like, okay, you're talking about this problem that is big, but what's the validation to it, right? So that was the second part of the story that I had to learn to tell the validation because people are afraid to take the chance unless like, you know, you hear external validation from somewhere. And then the third part of the story is packaging and selling yourself. So like, you know, no one wants to, because if people are convinced, like, you know, yes, there is a large market. People are convinced, yes, there is validation about this thesis of the large market.
So then it's why you?
Like, why you? Like, because the reality is like, if there's a large problem, there'll be multiple players. Why would you be the winning player? So you have to sell yourself and your story and your package yourself, right? So, and I learned how to do that so that I could tell that story, like, you know, why am I you know, uniquely positioned, you know, my past background, you know, my experience in, like, say, you know, other in that domain, you know, and if you create the right narrative around those three, that's when, like, you know, it's kind of strange, like, you know, I was struggling to get any term sheet, you know, for like
after 20 VCs. So
after 20 VCs, and then I got my first one, and then within a week I had six more. So because then
so
I knew
no one
the story
ever
was there.
Lemmings.
I think one thing I did during that process, like, you know, one of the VCs I was pitching to, I asked, so I was still in my job at that time, right? And I was like, you know, should I quit my job or not? And so this VC asked me, like, hey, do you really believe in this? I said, yes, I do. And so, like, so why are you still in your job then? And I was like, that's a good question. Like, I don't know the answer to this. So I slept over it, and next morning I quit my job.
Good.
It's like, you know, if I do believe in it, maybe I should quit my job then. You know, what's the, I'll try for 6 months, 9 months. If it works, it doesn't work, I can always find another job.
You get your first term sheet. Now you get, you know, within a week you have six. Uh-huh. How did you decide?
You decide based on factors on, like, which firms you like, which partners seem interesting, you know. The VC entrepreneur dynamic relationship, it's like it's a long marriage.
And like, you know, with the no divorce clause.
With the no divorce clause, right? So and you have to decide in like a few days on it, right?
So now you're funded, you have money in the bank, uh-huh. You have an idea, uh-huh. You're a solo founder, you know,
it's the
largest team you've managed is yourself before. So how did that go?
It's a very scary moment. Like, you know, I still remember that day when, so our Series A round, the first round was $5.5 million. There are $500 million in the bank, and I'm sitting in a room myself and kind of staring at the screen. Okay, I have $5.5 million now. What do, and I have this PowerPoint and some code. What do I do now? And it's kind of scary because you feel the sense of responsibility suddenly. Because
Absolutely.
You had this adrenaline for trying to raise money and all that, and now it's done, and it's like, okay, you suddenly feel the weight of responsibility that you have to fulfill that promise that you had. And the one thing I did learn is, like, you know, when you're running or building a startup, like, you know, and how I also personally evolved in doing that is that you go from, like, one stage to another, and or one set of problems to another. And I always look at, like, what's the most critical thing you have to solve? So the stage before was raising funding, like, because I couldn't get the company off the ground. That the next stage for me was, like, the most critical goal I set is to build a team. And so it's really
another view of the money. Let's go hire the best people that you
yeah,
get.
So, like, can I hire? And it's, you know, even if you have, you know, capital, it's not easy, like, you know, to hire your first person to come join you and the second person to join you, third person to join you. For those is really hard. You still are convincing. And, you know, for me, I was convincing first time in my career to, you know, join me as a team and join. So it's not, you know, and you start with calling people that you know and you respect, and which is what I did. And then, but once you run out of them, let's say, like, you know, they're not the right, let's say the timing is not right for them, or you can't convince them to join, then you have to go beyond that as convince them as well. So that's became, like, so let's call it, like, you know, the stage two for me, which, like, took, the funding process took me about 3 to 4 months, which was, you know, once that was achieved, I was, okay, now I have to build this core founding team of engineers to build this thing. And that took me another 4 or 5 months at least to get, like, you know, in a small team going.
Because, yes, it takes 3 to 6 months for
yes.
sure.
And then it was like, okay, now I had the team. The thing that starts, the big problem after that is, how do you find your product market fit? Because you started the company with a thesis on the problem.
So what is product market fit for you?
It's a very good question, because I kind of struggled with it for a long time. Okay, what does it mean, right? I did realize, like, you know, you have a product market fit when you've found a repeatable business case where you can, it's not about your technology works or not, right? It's really about you've identified a business case of why would someone buy and why would someone pay, and that's repeatable across, let's say, a large number of customers. For most startups, I will tell you, like, if you can, like, say, a B2B startup, like, say, what AppDynamics was, if you can get, like, you know, say, 5 to 10 customers who are paying you for similar business case, you have an early good product market. And you will still be involved heavily as a founder in those. You don't have to have, like, average salesperson, you know, selling to average user, because these will be mostly early adopter kind of customers.
Right.
But at least you have early product market fit. Would that scale? Not necessarily. Like,
so how long did it take you to get early product market fit, based on your definition?
So early
from,
market
from the day you
fit,
raised
it took
money.
It took me about 20 months. And we went through a few, because that's the period you will go through bunch of pivots, And you, those are the times you want to go through pivots, and because it's easier to, you know, once you have salespeople, it's hard to go through pivots. So you want to do it before you have anyone in sales. So it's because then it's the is the easiest. You have more freedom and flexibility to. That's where the founders have to go through a lot of customer conversations and interviews. So you know, my rule of thumb I've learned is you have to look at least 100 or so customer conversations. Because if you do 100 conversations, you will start realizing what's working in your message, what's working in your story, what's working in how your solution to the problem, and what's not. And are people are willing to, you know, pay for this or not? And if not, then you keep changing it, refining it, get to a point where it's a consistent thing that's working. And it takes time to, like, you know, at AppDynamics, we had to do multiple strong pivots because a lot of our initial assumptions were wrong. So
in the whole process of doing pivots, getting to early product market fit, this is one of the hardest things for a technical team that is going to market for the first time because you don't come into market with a Rolodex. You have to establish that Rolodex yourself. Are there one or two lessons that you learned, you know, that you think if I had to do this all over again, I would do things differently?
Sure. I'll tell you, like, the biggest thing I learned is that the concept of Rolodex is the most overrated and actually the most misleading concept. Because what these, like, technical founders, when they start, unfortunately, the investors and a lot of people promise them Rolodexes. That we have a Rolodex of customers and whatnot. In reality, no one has a Rolodex that will help
I agree,
startups.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if people have Rolodex, they will have, like, you know, maybe a handful of customers and maybe a CIO level person, which actually not very useful for early stage startup. You really want to get to the practitioners. Like, say, when I was building AppDynamics, I wanted to get to people who do performance monitoring and production troubleshooting. Did anyone had a Rolodex that I knew? Even my investors who all promised me Rolodex. And I initially thought, oh, maybe my investors will get me customers, and because they have a Rolodex.
No one can get you customers except yourself.
So that was the one lesson learned there. It kind of
depend on others for their Rolodexes.
There is no concept of Rolodex. No one has a Rolodex large enough for you to do that. Like, you know, if you really want a good product market fit and a strong product market fit, and you want to have 100 customer meetings, no one has a Rolodex that will get you 100 customer meetings like that. So you have to build a sort of a sales machinery to do that, which is, like, you know, which is really old-fashioned cold calling or, like, you know, growth hacking, you know, sending people, you know, mails on LinkedIn and sending people, finding a large number of people and go it in a way where you can find that many people. So, you know, I made the mistake initially. I was like, you know, okay, I need someone with a Rolodex to find these customer, do these customer meetings. And I would lean on my investors, and then made me two intros and three intros, and then after that it was done. And I was like, okay, if these three intros don't do anything to me, like, you know, to get a good sense, I need, you know,
many
more. I need 50, I need 100, because I want to make sure. And one thing I also learned is, like, you know, Rolodex sometimes could get you to the wrong conversations. Because a warm intro may not get you the most brutal feedback. So you want, in many cases, if you want a brutal feedback, it's still the cold, when you are trying to connect someone cold, and that's when you get the most
you
brutal
get the most
reality.
Honest feedback, yes.
Most honest feedback and the honest reality of the world. Like, if no one is willing to talk to you, and your message is not right, or maybe your problem is not relevant enough.
So would you do it yourself, or would you hire a salesperson early on?
Either way. Either you as founder or someone in the founding team does that or learn how to do it. Or you find someone like a salesperson or a, you know, a telesales, inside sales, you know, someone, you know, to do that. The challenge is hard to do it, like, you know, to find a salesperson to do that job where nothing to sell. So you, in most cases, founders have to take on a lot of it themselves. And I ended up taking a lot of it. That's one advice I give to all founders, like, you know, forget this concept of Rolodex. Learn how to cold call, how to, you know, do prospecting on LinkedIn, or find someone in your team who would do it. You know, because if you don't do it, you're not going to get enough customers to talk to. And if you don't get a wide enough volume of customers or a wide enough sample set, you're going to make
very basic mistakes,
mistakes
on the product strategy.
You will not correct your assumptions. And as founder, many times you're already biased to hear yes. You're already, like, you want to hear yes, you don't want to hear no, right? So and you're only talking to, like, five people, and, you know, you're already biased to hear yes. You probably won't hear the no, which is probably somewhere out there,
yeah.
Right? At that time, there's this report came out from someone, which was like the four horsemen of SaaS. It was, at that time, it was like Taleo, SuccessFactors.
Probably Salesforce.
Salesforce. and Concur.
Concur.
And I said, okay, let me call these guys and see, like, would they use my SaaS? And I called all four of them and got meetings, conversations with all four of them. All four of their IT departments said, we cannot use your SaaS. And I was, okay, this is as brutal of feedback as I can get.
We'll be right back.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably the kind of nerd who understands that encryption is one of the most popular and effective ways of protecting data. But even if encrypted at rest and in motion, did you also know that data are still vulnerable to attacks when an application starts to run? Wow, you are a nerd. When was the last time you were on a date? Well, that's where Fortanix comes in. Not with finding you a date. No technology can do that. What Fortanix does do is protect your data even when it's in use. We call it runtime encryption. With runtime encryption, your data are encrypted and safe even when in use by applications. Fortanix, we can't help you secure a date, but we can help you secure your data. Visit Fortanix.com to learn more about runtime encryption, our provable, portable, preventive security solution.
Any other lessons learned on product market fit before we move on to sort of the next phase of the company?
A few things that I've learned. One is, like, you know, the more brutal the feedback is, the more broader it is, the is better. Second is, you don't want to rely on Rolodex. As such, you have to start a machinery or some kind of process to increase the volume there. Third thing is really about how do you involve your entire engineering team in that process? Because I also learned the hard way, like, you know, when you're in the product market fit process, you want to be very flexible. Like, if you change your course or pivot or do changes, you slow down on it if your engineering team is not convinced on it. Because every time you're doing something and then you
learn to sell internally.
Yes, you have to sell internally because, like, say you're going on the path that we're going to build the SaaS product and SaaS only. And then you say, no, we learned that we have to build both SaaS and on-premise. Your engineering team will be like, you know, why do you keep changing things, right? Which will happen. And I initially tried to sell internally. And then I realized, like, you know, instead of trying to sell internally, I think it's best if I can put the team on the calls itself. Because then I don't have to sell. So what we did is, like, we kind of opened up all our customer calls. We said, okay, anyone can listen into them. And all our engineers, and we'll encourage them, like, you know, it's like we're doing all these calls. Try to just bring your laptop, work in the conference room while we're doing the call, and just listen into it and see what customers are saying. And once we did that, like, the alignment and convincing and internal selling problems just went away. And then people will be like, yeah, it's like we heard this on these three calls, so it's a no-brainer that we have to change this thing. So that changed the whole dynamic of how fast we can react and big adapt.
So bring the market into the company itself. Yes. and expose all the engineers to what's going on in the market so that instead of you being the conduit,
yep,
they're getting direct exposure.
Exactly. So that was definitely another lesson I learned. That.
How big was your team by this point?
Less than 10 people.
So you've gone from never having managed a person to now you have 10 people, mostly engineers still. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like? You know, now you're a CEO of a real company, still small,
yeah,
but it's a real company.
You learn to manage over time. You learn, like, you know, as if you think of, like, you know, personally as a founder, as like someone like me who never managed people, never ran a business before, you have to learn things, you know, which are not. So I call it, like, you know, the three things you have to really master. One is definitely the technology, because you come from that strength. So you don't want to undermine your strength or lose your primary advantage. The reason someone trusted you to be the founder for that is because you had the technology strength on it. So you don't want to lose that first. But there are a few other strengths you have to learn. And the first one is people, because you can't do anything just by yourself. So you have to recruit people, you have to inspire people, you have to manage people, you have to lead people, and you have to learn and put significant, like, let's say, energy and investment into being deliberate about it. And the third thing I realized very clearly that, you know, you have to master the, let's say, the customer acquisition process, but you can call it sales, that, you know, you can't do a business until you can really understand and become an expert in sales. Doesn't matter your technical background or not. And that's one of the things I tell every technical founder is, if you want to be successful as a technical founder, you have to understand people and become good in with people and managing people, leading people, working with people, all the aspects of people. And you have to become very good in understanding selling and believing in selling and learning selling and mastering selling, because without selling, there is no business. Selling sometimes it sounds like a bad word, like, you know, a lot of engineers think of, like, you know, sales as something not cool or interesting or exciting or whatnot, right? But to me, it's like, you know, I would tell any technical founder that unless you learn selling, you know, you can't recruit. Recruiting is also selling.
Recruiting is a sales process.
You know, you can't find customers, you can't find investors, you can't find, you know, it's, and it's the number one job of a founder is always selling. You're selling to your employees, you're selling to your customers, to your investors, to analysts, all sort of people you're selling. And you have to master
so
that.
So you become a salesman.
You have to. Sales is not the nicest word for it. You know, people say like you have to inspire people. And to me, that's no different, not too different than selling your vision, right? You're selling the vision, selling the, you know, the product, the solution, selling the, it's selling.
So now you have product, early product market fit. You have a handful of customers. You have 10 people in the team. What's next?
What's the next phase? You know, that's a very good question. That's where the, what I just talked about selling comes in, right? So we had that like early product, we are like,
it's roughly 2 years. It's been 2 years
roughly
now.
2 years, we had 5 customers paying, you know, we launched the product and seems clear, like now you have to scale. And the scaling is like, you know, a lot of that is about bringing more people in it, but it's really, a, you know, sales, the focus on sales becomes higher and higher at that point, right? So it's like, you know, if you look at like your journey as a startup, right? So the, from nothing, like which takes like 2 years from like an idea or a PowerPoint to let's say $500,000, $1 million kind of ARR, where you're kind of getting your initial early product market fit, or you know, in our case, it was even lower than that. In that point, that's like it's a very heavily product-oriented mindset. But the next steps, you have to start balancing the product-oriented market with a very heavy go-to-market mindset on like selling mindset. How do you hire salespeople? How do you hire like lead salespeople? How do you maybe you have to bring a head of sales to lead salespeople? How do you market broadly? How do you do demand generation? All sort of things like that. And that's the learning that you go through. Like, you know.
So building out the go-to-market function is the next big challenge.
It's
sales, the next
big...
marketing.
Yes.
What profile of people? Tell us about some of the one story of something that you got right and one mistake you made. Or maybe you made no mistakes.
No, I made mistakes, but, you know, fortunately, not like really bad ones, but you know, it's like I still remember like I was recruiting for the first sales rep, and I started interviewing, and I realized like I don't even know what to ask a sales rep, and you know, because you know, and most sales reps are polished and they will say the right kind of things, you know, and then you realize okay, maybe that's not the right thing. I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I do need to bring someone who knows how to do this, because otherwise I may mess it up. So I said, okay, instead of hiring sales reps, I need to bring a, you know, people go through this debate, like, should I bring sales reps or should I hire a VP of sales? And I tell people, like, if you don't know it, hire someone who knows it and learn from them before, instead of trying to like, you know, learn everything yourself, which is in a critical, in the critical path. So that I learned that and like, you know, and said, okay, I need to bring people who know more than me and otherwise I'm going to fail there. And
that's so you how hired I started a sales manager
so
or sales VP.
I had a good VP of sales. You know, same thing, I hired a good VP of marketing. There is no way, like my learning curve maybe 2 years on that. And I need to learn in like, you know, 6 months, not two years. So let's bring someone who's very good at it. I would think for most companies like you have to go from that $500,000, you know, kind of ARR to like almost like 8 to 10 million ARR when you start feeling confident on that. So that's like a 2 year journey.
That's a 2 year journey.
At least a 2 year. So that's the next, that's phase, which is the next phase, like salespeople who can sell it without you being involved as a founder. And I did a deliberate decision there. Initially, every deal I was involved as a founder, right? I need to get out of it though, that otherwise it's not going to scale. So I said, okay, let's maybe we set a rule like, you know, any deal less than $50,000, I'm not going to be involved in any way. And let it has to just happen by a sales organization. And then I moved that bar to $100,000 after, you know, it started to happen. After a few months, I raised the bar to $100,000. And then after, you know, 1 or 2 quarters, I raised the bar to $250,000. And eventually we raised the bar to $1 million. I remember like after many years, where $1 million deals were happening and I had no idea and I was tracking, but I didn't have to be involved. But that's how you scale. And that's when you get to a point where your salespeople can sell to a lot of people.
That's great.
So
you sort of start off with a sort of a low bar and then keep raising that bar up.
Yep.
Now, isn't it tempting to interfere? You see a deal, you see a salesperson, You know, you have a quarter to close, you know, there are these damn VCs who want you to beat plan.
No, see, that's the thing.
Or your VCs never cared about plan.
No, all VCs do, you know. But that's, you have to learn to trust the team, right? So obviously you want transparency, you want visibility, but you want people to run with things and you want to trust them and you want to, that's the only way you can scale. Otherwise, you can't scale, right? So the challenges are different, like, you know, for you to get to that, like call it, you can call it like the $1 to $10 million phase, where by that time, like, you know, you're, if the organization is completely dependent on you on every deal and you are micromanaging a deal or you have to jump into every deal, you are in a bad place.
So this is the next big phase. Now you have not only repeatability, you have scalability, because the average salesperson is selling to the average customer. You as a CEO are not involved day to day. And you had to learn to trust the team. You had to learn to sort of step away from the day to day. What else, lessons learned in this phase?
Let me correct. You don't have to step away from day to day. At that stage, you still are very involved in day to day. You just have to make sure you're spending your time on the right kind of things. And not like on every small thing, otherwise the system will bottleneck on you.
And how do you decide what are the right things?
There's no easy answer to it, because the right things may change every week or every month at least.
Or every hour.
But you have to pick what are the needle moving things, because there are hundreds of things going on. And initially I would I need to be involved in it, and people will involve me in everything, right? And I did realize that doesn't scale. So I need to pick what are the needle moving things. And I will ask this question does this move the needle one way or the other, either positively or negatively? If it doesn't, there is no point spending too much time on it.
It's interesting you talk about that, because I have a framework I use, which is this notion of you have to work in the business and you have to work on the business. Mm-hmm. And the notion of, when you're very early, even as a founder, CEO, you're working in the business. You're running hard to do whatever it takes, whether it's selling or coding or getting rid of the trash. As you try to scale the organization, you have to find a way to spend more and more time working on the business, which is figuring out what are the levers to pull with hiring the right VP of sales, setting the right metrics for the team, deciding what is the marketing approach. Mm-hmm. Because there's a fundamental difference between an inbound-driven approach versus an outbound-driven approach. And that decision is not just that of the VP of marketing. That's a decision that you as the CEO have to be part of. When most technical founders start a company, there is sort of this belief very often, even coming from investors, that they need a business co-founder or they need someone else to come in and step in as CEO. Did you ever feel that there was that bias?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of bias. If you're young, there is a bias against you. If you are an immigrant, you have a bias. There is a slight bias against you. And if you're technical, there is a bias against you. And I thought I had all three.
So you
try back down. But I was a young engineer, technical, with an immigrant accent and all that. So there was bias against me in ways where there shouldn't be. So I did learn that you have to make it a bit more logical. So what I would, and you have to ask yourself, why is there this bias? The bias is can this person is good in engineering? Can they learn how to inspire people? Can they learn how to raise capital? Can they learn how to learn sales, business, all those things, right? The exercise I did was so when I closed my Series A at $5 million, right? I sat down and said, okay, what is the next, big milestone for the company? And I said, okay, let's call it Series B and just start writing it backwards from that thing. And then I actually went to my board and investors hey, this is what I think we'll need 18 months or 24 months from now when we do Series B, that we need a product market fit established like that. We will need a team like this. We'll need maybe our beta customers or some initial set of customers. Is this right or not? And they gave me ideas on, this is, you won't be able to do this if you don't have these things. As an engineer.
So start with the goal in mind and work backwards.
As an engineer, it's easier to wrap your mind around this is the product I'm to build, or this is my goal for the company for Series B. This is what I need to engineer. What needs to be done after that, right? So that's what set me on the clarity on what I need to learn, because that's the goal. And I would set the goal again, what's the next major milestone? And which is 2 years from now, 3 years from now, what do I need, where the company needs to be, and how do I engineer backwards towards? And then it will translate to, what do I need to learn as CEO to do that? And am I willing to learn those or not? And if I'm not willing to learn those, maybe I need to bring someone in some ways to help me in some way, right? So that's how I navigated that. That's what I recommend people to.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this episode. You can subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Ashu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you are interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.